Have you ever had a chance or an opportunity or a situation where you find yourself kind of stepping out to do something that you don't really feel qualified to do? You know, it could have been a work thing where you've gotten a promotion, or maybe somebody else has kind of dropped the ball and you had to step into it. It can be a family thing where you become responsible for someone. Or I've heard many first-time parents kind of talk about that I don't know what to do here, sort of thing. In ministry, it's super common. When I first transitioned out of my old life into ministry, I'm like, who am I to do any of this? How could I be here? And you start to doubt yourself. And you start to wonder if you really belong here. And if you're not careful, you can actually develop something that's actually known as imposter syndrome, which is actual psychological diagnosis that you basically become so kind of gripped with fear and you don't feel qualified to do something that you're afraid that people are going to start to see you as an imposter, someone who's pretending to be something you're not. And the thing I want to talk about this morning as we come together is that we want to take a hold of that, that even if you're not in that situation right now, we all experience doubts in our lives. And we experience the greatest doubts, I truly believe this, that we experience the greatest doubts in our lives when we step out to do things that God calls us to do. That when God calls out to us to make a difference in the world, to serve other people, to serve one another, to be the person who shows up when others do not, that's scary. Because when you take a step forward and it feels like everyone else took a step back, you're like, I thought a bunch of us were going to do this, and it's just me. Or we'll do it, but you got to be responsible for everything. Well, that starts to weigh us down. That makes us feel like we're going to fail. That makes us feel like we're alone. And the thing that we want to do is we want to be willing to kind of trust a bit. To trust that even when we don't feel like we're doing well, we'll trust that God is with us. All right, so today as we continue our series that we called Beating the Odds, Facts, Faith, and Focus. That's what we want to look at. Right now, as we do this, we're going through the book of Esther. And what we look at throughout this series is this: how do we deal with difficulties in our lives? How do we actually step out and make a difference? Or how do we actually deal with things when things are weighing us down and we don't feel like we can go forward? And we kind of boiled it down to kind of these three points. Right, facts, faith, and focus. Right, facts, you got to face the facts. If you're in a difficult situation, you got to recognize it. If you're stepping out to do a job that's outside your skill level, the facts are you need to skill up. Right, you got to be able to do those sort of things. You may need to find help. Or you need to identify the facts. But then lean into your faith. Recognize that there are some things you can't control. And in reality, in life, you really can't control the big things. You can't control your genetics. You can't control the weather. Lots of big things we can't control. Turn those things over to God. Don't burn energy and anxiety on things you can't control. Turn those things over to God. But then also focus. You know, we don't want to be the person who just says, well, I prayed about it, I'm good. Yeah, pray about it, but you know what? Prepare. You know, there's a famous joke that ministers share with each other. There's this older minister who's like, you know, I never prepare. I just show up and I just wait for God to tell me what to say. And so one day he walks out on stage and says, okay, God, what do you want me to say? God says, I want you to tell everyone you didn't prepare. Right? We work hard. You know, you work hard. We all, if we're going to be successful at the things we do, we prepare. We focus on controlling the parts that we can. That's the idea. If you need greater skills, you skill up to deal with those things, whatever that means. If you need help, you ask for it. Now, remember that we're looking at Esther throughout this series. And in Esther, what we're looking at is someone who I think provides a really great model for how to apply these concepts, how to apply this kind of facts, faith, and focus situation. So basically what Esther shows us is that somehow a young lady who was an orphan, who was kind of without a home, she lived with her cousin Mordecai, somehow rose up to be the queen of Persia. And what's really interesting about that is that She was not Persian, and queens of Persia would have normally come from specific families, and somehow she rose up to do that. Now, over the past couple weeks, we've talked about all these things in detail just to kind of catch everyone up. If you haven't seen the earlier series, I encourage you to check out our website or our YouTube page to kind of catch up on those. But fundamentally, Esther is born into the conquered nation of Israel. And as part of the conquered nation of Israel, she is being ruled by the Persians, a government doesn't really care much about her. She was an orphan. She's being raised by a cousin, a guy named Mordecai, who cares for her a great deal. And she rises up to become the queen. Now, keep in mind, the queen here is not someone who has political authority, but she certainly has influence, she has privilege, and she's able to actually get her cousin Mordecai a position at the palace. He's actually a pretty respected official there. And so there's the kind of the heroes of our story, Esther and Mordecai. And then last week, we kind of met the villain. The villain's this guy named Haman. Now, remember that Haman was a high-ranking official in the kingdom. In fact, he's the highest ranking person except the king himself. And we also learned that he's a racist. And he gets offended by something Mordecai does or doesn't do. And he decides the way to get rid of Mordecai is to wipe out everyone of his race. Now, he didn't actually have the authority to do that on his own. But what he did do, or what he could do, was kind of convince the king that there's this group of people, and I'm not going to really tell you the details about that group of people, but we need to get rid of them. And he deceptively gets permission to do that. And so as we finished up last week, Esther realizes that she is the only one who can do something about this. Esther realizes that she's in the unique position to actually address this issue. And so when she realized that, what did she do? How did she address that issue when she realized that? Well, she kind of applied these ideas of facts, faith, and focus, right? That she looked at the facts, she looked at the details of the situation, and recognized that there were things that she could control and things she couldn't. So she leaned into her faith, right? That she actually says to Mordecai, her cousin, "You go gather your friends, have them pray for me. I'll get with my friends. I'll have them pray for me." And they pray and they fast for 3 days. But she didn't just do that. She also used that 3 days to put together a plan. And so what we're going to look at today is how she executes that plan. What was the ideas that she came up with? And what she faces, and why this is such a big deal, is that she needs to talk to the king. She's the one who uniquely can get to the king. But no one can talk to the king uninvited. And what happens to a person who goes to see the king without being invited? You die. That is literally the punishment for it. Unless the king intercedes, you're executed automatically, even if you're the queen. And we might be thinking that, well, he wouldn't get rid of his queen. But how did the story start? Why does Esther have the job? Right? Because he got rid of the last queen. Because he has that kind of authority. So now that she's done all that, she's prepared. She's prayed. How does it go? So it tells us that on the third day of the fast, Esther put on her royal robes and entered the inner court of the palace just across from the king's hall. The king was sitting on his royal throne facing the entrance. Now reading that, that seems like, well, okay, she walks in. But this is the moment that she breaks protocol. This is the moment she does what she's not allowed to do. Because what we want to understand is that the palace is organized into what's called the inner court and the outer court. The inner court is the kind of the king's kind of private area. This is that place where no one is allowed to enter unless they're invited. But there's also something called the outer court, and we might think of that like as the waiting room. So if you want to see the king, you go to the outer court and you wait for him to invite you in. But it's not like you kind of have an appointment. He's the king. He can decide not to see you. And we do know this king is kind of moody. That the historical record tells us that he was kind of, well, just say kind of moody, right? And so he might say yes. He might say no. He might ignore you. And this is so important that she can't live with that. She needs to talk to him. So she makes the decision to just walk straight in and talk to him and actually put her life at risk. But now, if we notice here, what does she do? When she goes to see him, she does something really important. It says she put on her royal robes. Now, that sounds simple enough to us. She just puts on her royal robes. But that's not what it means. What it's saying is that she has to realize who she is. She has to trust that she is here for this moment. Because remember, when she arrived, what was she? She was a scared little orphan girl. If she walks into the king like she's the scared little orphan girl and just kind of begs, chances of success aren't that high. So she makes a decision. She says that, yes, I was that girl, but I'm not that girl anymore. I'm the queen now. So I'm going to walk in like the queen. I'm going to act like the queen. I'm going to look like the queen. So when we talk about putting on her royal robes, what she's basically doing is putting on her royal garments that she is entering made up as if this is a royal event. So I'm going to walk in like the queen. I'm going to act like the queen. And I'm going to expect the king to treat me like I'm the queen. And remember that this is kind of how it all started, that when she first kind of got a chance to meet the king, that she came in prepared with her presence. And in the time that she's been here, she's learned lots of things. She's learned how to interact. She's learned more about protocol. She's learned almost definitely more about politics and how to kind of move things along. Again, she doesn't have political power, but she lives in a political environment. Basically saying that I am the queen, that comes with rights, that comes with privileges, and I'm going to use those. And I believe that this is much more than self-motivation. This isn't just like I'm going to pump myself up and believe that, you know, I am good enough, I am smart enough, you know, that sort of thing. It's like, no, I'm here to do something. That God has put me on this earth at this moment in time. And this is a difficult situation, but it is no surprise to God that I'm the one that's here. And I've got access, opportunity, and resources that will allow me to move things forward. And the thing that I want us all to understand is we're all in that situation. Right? Whatever stage of life you are in, you have access to somebody's life, you have opportunity to make a difference, and you have resources that you can leverage. All right? And resources don't have to be money. Right? It could just be, you know, a membership to a club where you get to know some people. It just may be things you can use to kind of make a difference. And when we find ourselves in that situation, and we look at the world around us where there are people who are hurting, there are people who are hungry, there are people who don't know Jesus, we live in a time of off-the-charts emotional non-well-being of young people. As, well, I say young people, kind of all of us, right? But especially kind of younger generations and kind of middle-aged generations, right? Off the charts. You know, longing for community, longing for purpose, longing for transcendent truth in their lives, things that actually last more than some video that kind of disappears in 24 hours. Real truth in their lives. You know, and so many folks of us here have been Christians their whole lives. People like me became Christians later in life, and we all have had a path and an influence of Jesus in our lives. And that's an incredible resource. And so if we look at the things we have, the material things we have, the spiritual things we have, the opportunities, the question that I would encourage us all to ask ourselves, that I want each one of you to ask yourself, that I ask myself, all those things that I have, are they just for my comfort? Are they just to make my life easier? Now, there's nothing wrong with your life, you know, using what you have to kind of make your life good. There's nothing wrong with that. But are they just for that? Or are maybe, just maybe, just like Queen Esther, you're here in this time and this place with your experiences, your resources, your opportunities to make a difference in someone's life. It may be one person's life, it may be two people's life, it may be hundreds or thousands. We never know until we start. That's the question that we all have to answer for ourselves. Are you here to do something with what you have, or are you here just to consume the things that you have? That was the question that Esther faced. That's what she had to deal with. And in the case of Esther, she chose to actually leverage that. That she chose to step before the king as she stepped into the call on her life. And she knew that in her case, she could literally save thousands of lives, but it might cost her her own life. So all this is in her head as she steps before the king, having no idea how this is going to go. So she steps before the king. What happens? It says, when the king saw Queen Esther standing there in the inner court, he welcomed her and held out the gold scepter to her. In other words, he's acknowledging her. He's saying that it is okay for her to be here. So she's kind of advanced her cause. She's gotten over the big hurdle here. She has gotten in front of the king. And I truly believe that this happened because of the fact that she understood the dangers of the situation. She understood the facts of her situation, what she had access to. She put her faith in God. She prayed. But she also focused on building a really good plan, being ready, showing up ready. And all those things converge. She shows up like the queen, and the king treats her like she's the queen. The narrative goes on to tell us. Then the king asked her, "What do you want, Queen Esther? What is your request? I will give it to you even if it is half the kingdom." Now, just for clarity, that's hyperbole. He's not actually offering her half the kingdom. It's basically, you know, you look like $1 million sort of thing, right? Yeah. But it is saying that I see you favorably. What are you looking for? So as she says, or as he asks that question, Esther replies, "If it please the king, let the king and Haman come to the banquet today I have prepared for the king." Now, think about this for a second. She literally just risked her life to ask him a question. He's clearly favorable to her. And her ask is, "Would you come to dinner with me? Oh, and bring that Haman guy too." Now, what's she doing there? Did she kind of just crumble in the moment? Did she choke? You know, this was her chance and she broke. She's exercising wisdom. Look, if you're like me, I'll speak entirely for myself. Some of you will identify, some of you won't. In my life, when I face a problem, what I want to do is I want to face it straight on. I want to run into it. I want to hit it with brute force, break the wall, get through. Let's get this done. That technique was not going to work with the king. The king has ultimate authority. He answers to no one. And he's really moody. And so she may walk in and he may kind of respond favorably to her, but if he's in a mood and she makes this really big ask of, you know, trying to stop the execution of these people, he may just say no. So she decides she's not going to leave this to chance. She's going to create an environment that improves her chances. She's focused on building a really good plan. She's focused on giving herself the best chance she can. So basically, she asked that question, which is kind of a small ask. And I really think, too, that what she's doing here is saying that, hey, remember how much you liked me when I first got here? Remember how much fun we had when I first got here? Let's go hang out and have dinner again. Let's just hang out and kind of have a casual time together. And let's invite Haman, your kind of your top official. Let's kind of make this kind of, you know, kind of an important meeting, but let's just kind of hang out and do that. And it appears that it works, because it says, "The king turned to his attendants and said, 'Tell Haman to come quickly to a banquet as Esther has requested.' So the king and Haman went to Esther's banquet." So in step two, her plan is progressing. And as her plan progresses, she actually kind of continues to leverage things, because she definitely kind of creates some great conversation between the senior official, herself, the king. The wine kind of flows, which kind of softens the king a little bit further, makes him more receptive to other things. But now the king, you know, I say he's moody, but he's not, you know, he's not unintelligent. He knows the risk that Esther took stepping in front of him. He knows that wasn't just to have dinner. So he's like, you know, What's going on? What do you really want? Now, we might think that, okay, she's got a little wine in him. This is her moment to jump. But she knows how to keep the king's attention. Right? The king is a guy that can have anything he wants. So be that thing that he can't quite have. So he says, what is it that you really want? She says, this is my request and deepest wish. If I have found favor with the king, and if it pleases the king to grant my request and do what I ask, please come with Haman tomorrow to the banquet I will prepare for you. Then I will explain what this is about. She's keeping the chase going. She's keeping it interesting. What else is she doing? She's keeping herself on his mind for another day and another night. So the king just spends time thinking about, wow, what could she really want? And why would she have Haman there? So she's creating curiosity. She's creating interest. She's making him more favorable to her. She's softening his heart, in a sense. Again, because she understands that the best way to deal with these things is finesse. But we also want to keep in mind that she's dealing with a two-part problem here. She's got to deal with the king, and she's got to deal with Haman. Right? So she's clearly managing the king really well. She knows him well. She knows how to do this. But Haman's a different kind of nut to crack, so to speak, right? That Haman is a deeply political person. He is very successful in politics. He's very successful in power circles. And she knows that for Haman being invited to this, he would be on guard. He would be wondering, what is this about? So recognizing that, she knows that if she was to suddenly blurt out at dinner that, hey, Haman's trying to kill my whole family and all everybody I know, Haman might quickly spin that because he's ready for this. He knows that something is unusual. And so he might just deny it. He may make up some story that just makes it look bad for Esther and she loses the situation. So she wants to kind of deal with Haman's strengths and weaknesses, right? She wants to disarm his strengths, which is his political abilities, by playing his weaknesses. Do you remember what his weaknesses are, or his main weaknesses? He's arrogant. He's prideful. Very few people get to have dinner with the king and queen once. What she's saying is that, Haman, oh, you are so wonderful. You are so delightful. Oh my goodness, having you here with us today was so amazing. I would just love to have you here with us again. His weakness is his pride, his arrogance. And so she plays to it, to kind of soften him, to take him off his guard. And again, it appears that everything is working. So basically, this encounter then kicks off a string of events that really positions Esther for success. Because as Haman walks out, he's really, really excited. He is so like, wow, this is awesome. He's so filled with kind of joy. In fact, it actually says that Haman was a happy man as he left the banquet. In other words, she has fully played to his arrogance. Wow, this is awesome. No one else gets to do this. But remember that he's arrogant, but he expects people to fear him, to bow down to him, to recognize his power. And so his joy is quickly crushed. It says that. But when Haman saw Mordecai sitting at the palace gate, not standing up or trembling nervously before him, Haman became furious. And I just want to kind of step off to the side. How often do we do that? We have this thing in our lives that we think is really good, and we're kind of really happy about it, and some completely unimportant thing happens that makes us angry, and it blows the whole thing up. You know, you're super excited about something, things are going really well, and you get stuck in traffic, and suddenly you're just angry and yelling and losing your cool. You know, or you're just excited about something, and something else goes differently, and you completely lose your cool, and you destroy your own joy. I destroy my own joy because I've just put too much weight on anything. I mean, whether Mordecai fears Haman or not doesn't actually change Haman's life. He's still the, you know, other than the king, the most powerful person in the kingdom. Mordecai's actions have no direct impact on Haman's life, except for those that Haman chooses to allow them to have. And so the thing that I want to invite each of us to do is that when something starts kind of getting on your nerves, irritating you, causing you to blow your top. And to be clear, I'm talking to myself with every word I say. Think about, does this really matter? Does this really impact your life? Does this really need to steal your joy in this moment? Does this really need to take you out of that great time you're having with your family? You know, the next time, you know, you're driving, you completely blow your top, and you look over at your spouse who was looking forward to going out to dinner with you. What has that done? It's all the experiences. What do we steal from ourselves by behaving that way? And in the case of Haman, this experience of seeing Mordecai kicks off this series of events that will actually start to move the situation more in Esther's favor. Because he becomes so angry, he decides that Mordecai has to die now. Now keep in mind, Haman already has permission by the king to wipe out the entire race of people that Mordecai is part of. Now he's got to wait a few months to do it, but he already has permission. But Haman gets so upset, he's like, no, Mordecai has to die tomorrow. So he goes home ready to do that. Now again, he doesn't have the authority to do it on his own. So again, he needs the king's permission. So he decides to go see the king in the morning. Now what Mordecai doesn't know is that Haman was unable to sleep that night. Excuse me, the king was unable to sleep that night. I said names wrong, I'm going to say it all again, sorry. What Haman doesn't know is that the king was unable to sleep that night. Why was he unable to sleep? Was he thinking about Esther? I don't know. Probably. But what the king does when he can't sleep, he does what some of us do when we can't sleep. He reads. But when he reads, it's a little different than us. You know, if I can't sleep, I'll grab usually a nonfiction book to read, or maybe you get a fiction book to read just to hoping to fall asleep. When the king can't sleep, he calls in an attendant. Read to me. And when he wants to be read to, or what he wants read to him, is not, you know, some history of the world. Read to me the history of my own kingdom. Read to me the history of all the great things I've done. And so throughout the night, this attendant reads the history of the king's kingdom to the king. You mean like all that stuff you were there for, sort of thing. And so by morning comes, and when morning comes, Haman shows up to see the king. He has to follow the protocol. So Haman goes into the outer court, waiting to be called in by the king. Just as that happens, the attendant reads to the king the story of when the two men we read about last week were trying to kill the king. But there were two men who wanted to kill the king, and how was that stopped? Mordecai stepped in. So literally, just as Haman is about to walk in asking, hey, can I kill Mordecai today? Which is so ridiculous when you say it out loud, right? Hey, can I kill Mordecai today? The attendant says to the king, you know, Mordecai saved your life. And the king's like, well, what did we ever do to reward him? And it turns out that there's nothing. They didn't do anything. So the king asks, well, who's waiting in the outer court right now? They tell him, well, it's Haman. Tell Haman to come on in. And it says that, so Haman came in, and the king said, what should I do to honor a man who truly pleases me? Now, when Haman hears that question, what's Haman's greatest weakness? Pride and arrogance. Well, Haman thought to himself, who would the king wish to honor more than me? So what does Haman really want, right? He loves this idea of people bowing down to him, people recognizing his power. So what Haman starts to do is describe all the things that he wants. Oh, if you want to honor someone, king, put the royal robes on them, the same ones you wear. Put those on that person. And then take out one of your beautiful horses that only you ride, the ones with the big king's seal on their head, and put that person on that horse. He wants to look like the king. He wants to be treated like the king. And then he goes even further, and he says that, and then once that person's on the horse, have one of your highest officials lead that horse through the streets, yelling out over and over again, this is what the king does for those he wishes to honor. And so he describes all that, expecting to receive it himself. And the king says, excellent idea. Quick, take the robes and my horse and do just as you have said for Mordecai the Jew, who sits at the gate of the palace. Leave nothing out that you have suggested. And for Mordecai, excuse me, I keep doing this, sorry. For Haman, this is probably as about humiliating of an experience as it can possibly be. He can't go against the king's order. He showed up here asking for permission to kill Mordecai. And instead, he is now personally required to put the robe on Mordecai, to get the horse, get him on the horse, and then Haman himself has to walk through the streets leading the horse with Mordecai on its back while he says, this is what the king does for someone he wishes to honor, repeating that over and over again. So how did this experience impact those two men? How does it impact Mordecai? How does it impact Haman? Well, it says that, well, afterwards, Mordecai returned to the palace gate, but Haman hurried home dejected and completely humiliated. So for Mordecai, Mordecai didn't really care. It's like he gets done, he just goes back to work, right? But for Haman, this was crushing. And Haman will actually go home just so upset that he starts to talk to his friends and his wife, hoping for comfort. And they're like, oh man, Mordecai's got you beat. You're done. You're never going to prevail here. So he was already crushed. The people he was counting on to kind of lift him up, kind of beat him down more. And it seems that things are so bad, he has either forgotten that there's a second dinner he has to go to, or he's thinking about not going. Because what we know is that he should already be at the dinner, and two of the king's attendants show up at his house saying, hey, you're supposed to be at the dinner. And they kind of get him and take him to the dinner right away. And what's happened here is I think we see the convergence of faith and focus in this moment. Right, that Esther has been building a really good plan, that she has drawn this out to make herself more favorable to the king. She has drawn this out hoping to knock Haman's guard down a little bit. So that's her focus. But her faith shows up because God's done something she couldn't have done. Right? She couldn't be sure that the king wouldn't sleep that night. She certainly couldn't have known that Haman was going to decide that this was the day to kill Mordecai and show up at just the right time for the king to ask him to do something that's totally humiliating. So Haman, this incredibly effective political animal, shows up already beaten to the dinner. And what we see happening now is that she talks to the king and finally says to the king, this is what I'm looking for. She says she wants to ask for the life of her and her people. I've asked you here because I want to ask you to save the life of me and my people. She says it like this. For my people and I have been sold to those who would kill, slaughter, and annihilate us. And again, the thing here is that we see her working this well-thought-out plan. She could have walked in and said, hey, there's someone who wants to kill all my people. And the king might care, might not care. I mean, kings deal with, in this era, you know, what, 500 years before Christ? In this era, royals decided for people to die all the time. He may not have cared. But what does she do? For my people and I. This affects me. But she really makes it really clear that when this affects me, it's impacting your queen. And the king would then see that as an attack, not just on a group of people, not just on a woman he cared about, but on his kingdom himself, because a threat to the queen is a threat to the king, and a threat to the king is a threat to the kingdom. So her well-chosen words draws the king way in. And basically, he just kind of bursts out, who would do such a thing? Who would be so presumptuous as to touch you? Now, my bet is that Haman's feeling pretty sick about now, that things aren't going very well, because remember that Haman has no idea that Esther is Jewish. Remember that when she came into the palace, she never said where she was from. And there were lots of girls coming to that palace that time. Nobody's really paying attention to where they were from. So no one knows she's Jewish. So Haman had no idea that this plan that he had put together was going to involve the queen. He didn't think anybody would really care. And so the king's like, well, again, who would do this to you? And she says, this wicked Haman is our adversary and our enemy. And Haman grew pale with fright before the king and the queen. And so as the king hears this, he is furious, and he jumps up with rage. And we don't really know why he walks out of the room. Was he afraid he was going to do something rash? Did he just want a minute to think about it? Did he just need a second to breathe? But in a rage, he walks out of the room. And Haman finds himself realizing that his life is now in Esther's hands. That the king is almost definitely going to want to kill him. But if Esther could talk the king out of it, maybe he has a chance. So what Haman does is not really a good idea to do to the queen. In despair, Haman fell on the couch where Queen Esther was reclining, just as the king was returning from the palace garden. So in an attempt to save himself, he literally jumps on the furniture where the queen is. And of course, the king exclaimed, will he even assault the queen right here in the palace before my very eyes? And as soon as the king spoke, his attendants covered Haman's face, signaling Haman's doom. So in that moment, the plan has come together. A plan that is built entirely off of these kind of three ideas. Facing the facts, knowing your reality, embracing your faith, leaning on God, seeking God's leading, but also focus, right? Do the work that you can do. That if you're going to make a difference in this world, if you're going to make a difference in the lives of people you care about, yes, absolutely pray. Absolutely. But work really hard too. Use all the gifts you've been given. That God is trusting you, he's trusting me to use the gifts, the opportunities, the access that we have to make a difference in this world. He won't make you do it. But he's trusting you to do it. He's trusting that you will use the gifts you've been given to do something. And a really key part of that kind of comes back to that thing I opened with this idea of imposter syndrome. So often the thing that keeps us from doing what we're capable of doing, I think the thing that keeps us from doing what we're called to do, is embracing your identity in Christ. Embracing the fact that you are created with a purpose. I say this all the time. I never get tired of saying it. You are created on purpose with a purpose. The question is, do you embrace it? Do you step into it? Do you use the things that are given to you? You know, and one of the key things I think of embracing your identity as we talk about this idea of faith is that you want to really make conversation with God a daily part of your lives, right? So you definitely should be praying every day. I really encourage you to pray every day. But if all you do is pray, you're doing all the talking, right? And just to kind of look at you and your relationship with your spouse, if you do all the talking, I'll talk to the guys. If you do all the talking, how's that going to go? It ain't going to go well at all, you know? And I will be the first to admit, I would miss out on a lot of things that make me live my life a little bit better. Maybe just if I just listened, it would do that in the first place, but I actually get some real information too, sort of thing. Right? That I always joke that without Bonnie, I wouldn't make it anywhere. I'd just be lost at home. I can't find my shirt. I couldn't find my socks, my shirt, or my underwear, and I wouldn't be here, sort of thing. Right? But the reality is that we want to be in conversation with God. And a conversation goes in two directions. Prayer is us talking to God. Some folks are able to kind of feel like they hear from God as they kind of meditate quietly, but the clearest place to hear from God is the Word of God. To embrace that process, create a daily habit of praying and listening to God through His Word. Some people like to read multiple chapters a day. Some people like to read a chapter a day. Some people like to read a couple of verses a day. Download the YouVersion Bible app and they'll send you a verse every day. Right? And if we do that, we begin to hear from God. That the Word of God is so powerful, you don't need to consume a lot of it to get something out of it. So embrace that truth. And in that, you can do the work that you're called to. Now back to Esther. It seems like all is well, right? Esther and Mordecai have worked together to get rid of Haman. Haman is the man who put this kill order out for her entire people. Haman's gone. It seems like everything is good. So Esther goes to the king, saying that, well, now that Haman is gone, he's the one who's ordered to have my people killed. Please rescind that order. But the king says, remember, what has already been written in the king's name and sealed with his signet ring can never be revoked. So in other words, when an official order comes out in the king's name, sealed with a signet ring, a special ring with a seal on it, that is a non-rescindable order. Even the king himself cannot take that order away. So the king says, I will do anything for you I can to help you, except I can't pull that kill order back. So what are they going to do? We'll find out next week as we wrap up the series, Beating the Odds, Facts, Faith, and Focus.